Chapter 5. Gen was a busy man. He was needed by Mr. Hosokawa, who wanted another 10 words and their pronunciations to add to his book. He was needed by the other hostages, who wanted to know how to say, "Are you finished with that newspaper?" in Greek or German or French. Then he was needed to read the newspaper to them if they did not read in Spanish. He was needed by Messner every day to translate the negotiations. Mostly he was needed by the generals, who had conveniently mistaken him as Mr. Hosokawa's secretary instead of his translator. They appropriated his services. They liked the idea of having a secretary, and soon they were waking Gen up in the middle of the night, telling him to sit with a pencil and pad while they dictated their latest list of demands for the government. What they wanted seemed to Gen to be unformed. If their plan had been to kidnap the president in order to overthrow the government, they hadn't bothered to think any further than that. Now they talked in generalities about money for the poor. They dredged up the names of every person they had ever known who was in jail, which seemed again to be an inexhaustible list. Late at night, in deliriums of power and generosity, they demanded that everyone be set free. They moved beyond political prisoners. They remembered the car thieves they had known from boyhood, the petty robbers, men who stole chickens, a handful of drug traffickers who were not entirely bad sorts once you knew them. "Don't forget him," Alfredo said, and gave Gen an irritating poke on the shoulder. "You have no idea how that man has suffered." They admired Gen's neat penmanship, and when they found a typewriter in the bedroom of the vice president's oldest daughter, they were impressed with Gen's ability to type. Sometimes in the middle of transcription, Hector would say, "In English," and then Alfredo, "In Portuguese." How amazing it was to watch over his shoulder while he typed on in different languages. It was like having an incredibly fascinating toy. Sometimes, when it was very late, Gen would type up everything in Swedish without benefit of umlauts in an attempt to amuse himself, but he did not feel amused anymore. As far as Gen could tell, there were only 2 hostages who were not fabulously wealthy and powerful, himself and the priest, and they were the only 2 who were made to work. Of course, the vice president worked, but not because anyone had asked him to. He seemed to think that the comfort of his guests was still his responsibility. He was always serving sandwiches and picking up cups. He washed the dishes and swept, and twice a day he mopped up the floors in the lavatories. With a dish towel knotted around his waist, he took on the qualities of a charming hotel concierge. He would ask, "Would you like some tea?" He would ask, "Would it be too much of an impossibility to vacuum beneath the chair in which you were sitting?" Everyone was very fond of Lubin. Everyone had completely forgotten that he was the vice president of the country. Rubén Iglesias delivered a message to Gen while he waited for the generals to make up their minds as to what they wanted to say next. He was needed at the piano. Roxanne Koss and Kato had a great deal to discuss. Could they spare Gen at this particular moment? They were all in favor of keeping the soprano happy and possibly hearing her sing again, and so they consented to let Gen go. Gen felt like he was a schoolboy called out of class. He remembered his neat box of pencils, the clean pad of paper, the luck of having a desk next to the window simply because of where his name fell in the alphabet. He was a good student, and yet he remembered at every moment how desperately he wished to leave the room. Rubén Iglesias took his arm. "I suppose the problems of the world will have to wait," he whispered, and then he laughed in a way that no one could hear him at all. Mr. Hosokawa stayed at the piano with Kato and Roxanne. It was a pleasure to hear so much talk of opera translated into Japanese, to hear Roxanne Koss's conversation in Japanese. It was different to listen to what she said to him and what she said when she was speaking to someone else, speaking to someone about music. There was a regular education to be had from eavesdropping. So much of what was learned was accidentally overheard, just half a sentence caught when walking through the door. Since they had been taken hostage, Mr. Hosokawa had felt the frustration of the deaf. Even as he diligently studied his Spanish, it was only occasionally that he heard a word he recognized. All his life he had wanted more time to listen, and when finally there was time, there was nothing to listen to, only the patter of voices he could not understand. the occasional screeching of the police beyond the wall. The vice president had a stereo system, but he seemed only to have a taste for local music. All of his CDs were of bands playing high-pitched pipes and crude drums. The music gave Mr. Hosokawa a headache. The generals, however, found it inspiring and would not grant requests for new CDs. But now Mr. Hosokawa pulled his chair up to the piano and listened. Everyone stayed in the living room, hostages and terrorists alike, in hopes that Kato might be persuaded to play again, or better still, that Roxanne Koss might sing. Carmen seemed especially intent on watching Roxanne. She considered herself to be Roxanne's bodyguard, her personal responsibility. She stood in the corner and stared at their party with unwavering concentration. Beatrice chewed on the end of her braid for a while, making talk with the boys her own age. When no music seemed to be immediately forthcoming, she and a few of her cohorts snuck off to watch television. Only Mr. Hosokawa and Gen were invited to sit with the two principal players. "I like to sing scales first thing in the morning," Roxanne said, after breakfast. "I'll work on some songs, Bellini, Tosti, Schubert. If you can play the Chopin, you can play those." Roxanne ran her fingers over the keys for the opening of Schubert's Die Forella.
"If we can get the music," Kato said.
"If we can get dinner brought in, we can get sheet music. I'll have my manager put a box together and send it down. Someone can fly it down. Tell me what you want." Roxanne looked around for a piece of paper, and Mr. Hosokawa was able to produce his notebook and pen from the inside pocket of his jacket. He opened it to a blank page towards the back and handed it to her. "Ah, Mr. Hosokawa," Roxanne said. "Imprisonment would be something else altogether without you."
"Surely you've been given nicer gifts than a pad of paper and a pen," Mr. Hosokawa said.
"The quality of the gift depends on the sincerity of the giver. It also helps if the gift is something the receiver actually wants. So far you've given me your handkerchief, your notebook, and your pen, all three things I wanted."
"The little I have here is yours," he said with a sincerity that didn't match her lightness. "You could have my shoes, my watch.
You have to save something for the future so you can surprise me." Roxanne tore off a sheet of paper and handed the notebook back. "Keep up with your studies. If we stay here long enough, we'll be able to cut Gen out of the loop." Gen translated and then added,
"I'll put myself out of business."
"You can always go back to the jungle with them," Roxanne said, looking over her shoulder at the generals who spent their free time watching her. "They seem to want to give you a job."
"I would never give him up," Mr. Hosokawa said.
"Sometimes," Roxanne said, touching Mr. Hosokawa's wrist for just a second, "these matters are out of our control." Mr. Hosokawa smiled at her. He was reeling with the naturalness of their discourse, the sudden ease with which they passed the time. Imagine, if it hadn't been Kato who played the piano, it could have been one of the Greeks or a Russian. Then he would have been locked out again, listening to English translated to Greek and Greek into English, knowing that Gen, his translator, would not have the time to then repeat every sentence in Japanese. Kato said he would like some foray if it wouldn't be too much trouble, and Roxanne laughed and said that nothing could be trouble at this point. Wonderful Kato. He scarcely seemed to notice her. It was the piano he couldn't take his eyes off. He had always been a tireless worker, and now he was the hero of the day. There would be a healthy raise when all of this was over. Messner came in as usual at 11 in the morning. Two of the young soldiers patted him down at the door. They made him take off his shoes and they peered inside them, looking for tiny weapons. They patted his legs and frisked beneath his arms. It was a ridiculous habit that had grown not out of suspicion, but out of boredom. The generals struggled to keep their soldiers in the mindset of battle. More and more, the teenagers sprawled on the leather sofa in the vice president's den and watched television. They took long showers and trimmed each other's hair with a pair of elegant silver scissors they found in the desk. And so the generals doubled the night watch and guard duty. They made their soldiers patrol the house in pairs and sent two more outside to walk along the edge of the yard in the drizzling rain. When they went, they carried their rifles loaded and held them up as if they were looking to shoot a rabbit. Messner submitted to this drill with patience. He opened his briefcase and slipped off his shoes.
He held his arms out straight to either side and moved his sock feet wide apart so that the strange little hands could rummage around his body as they saw fit. Once one of them tickled him on the ribs and Messner brought his hand down sharply. "Basta," he said. He had never seen such an unprofessional group of terrorists. It was a complete and utter mystery to him how they had ever managed to overtake the house. General Benjamin swatted Renato, the boy who had tickled Messner, and took his gun away from him. All he had hoped for was some semblance of military order.
"There is no call for that," he said sharply.
Messner sat down in a chair and retied his shoes. He was irritated with the whole lot of them. By now this trip should be forgotten, the snapshots developed, shared, and placed into an album. He should be back in his overpriced apartment in Geneva with the good view and the Danish modern furniture he had so carefully collected. He should be taking a packet of mail from the cool hands of his secretary in the morning. Instead, he went to work, inquiring how the group was doing. He had been practicing his Spanish, and even though he kept Gen close by, for a sense of security as much as a backdrop for his vocabulary, he was able to conduct much of the informal conversation on his own.
"We are growing tired of this," the general said and
ran his hands back over his head.
"We want to know why your people cannot find resolution. Must we start killing hostages to get your attention?"
"Well, first off, they are not my people," Messner pulled the laces tight. "Nor is it my attention you should be trying for. Don't kill anyone for my benefit. You have my complete attention. I should have gone home a week ago."
"We all should have gone home a week ago," General Benjamin sighed, "but we have to see our brothers released."
For General Benjamin, of course, this meant both his philosophical comrades and his literal brother, Luis. Luis, who had committed the crime of distributing flyers for a political protest, and was now buried alive in a high-altitude prison. Before his brother's arrest, Benjamin had not been a general at all. He had taught grade school. He had lived in the south of the country near the ocean. He had never had a moment's trouble with his nerves.
"That is the issue," Messner said, looking over the room, doing a quick tally of all present. "And is there progress?" "Nothing I've heard of today."
He reached into his case and took out a sheaf of papers.
"I have these for you. They're demands. If there's anything new you want me to request." "Señorita Cos," General Benjamin said, hitching his thumb in her direction. "There's something she wants."
"Ah, yes."
"There is always something for Señorita Cos," the general said. "Kidnapping women is a different business entirely from the kidnapping of men. I hadn't thought of it before. For our people, freedom. For her, something else. Dresses, possibly."
"I'll see about it,"
Messner said, and tipped his head, but he didn't get up to leave right away.
"Is there anything I can get for you?"
He indicated nothing directly, but he was wondering about the shingles, which every day seemed to cast their coarse red net another millimeter across the general's face, and would soon be dipping their fingers into the cool water of his left eye.
"There is nothing I require."
Messner nodded and excused himself. He preferred Benjamin to the other two. He found him to be a reasonable man, possibly even intelligent. Still, he worked hard to prevent any feeling of real fondness for him, for any of them, captors or hostages. Fondness often prevented one from doing the most effective job. Besides, Messner knew how these stories usually ended. It seemed better to avoid much personal involvement. But no sensible rules applied to Roxanne Koss. Most days there was something she wanted, and while the generals could care less about the requests of the other hostages, they were quick to give in to her. Every time she asked for something, Messner would feel his heart quicken slightly, as if it was him she wanted to see. One day it was dental floss, one day a muffler, then some herbal throat lozenges that Messner was proud to note came from Switzerland. Other hostages had gotten into the habit of asking Roxanne when there was something that they needed. When she asked for men's socks or sailing magazines, she never blinked. "Have you heard the good news?" Roxanne said.
"There's good news now?"
Messner tried to be rational. He tried to understand what it was about her. Standing next to her, he could look down on the place where her hair parted. She was just like the rest of them, wasn't she? Except perhaps for the color of her eyes. "Mr. Cotto plays the piano."
At the mention of his name, Kato stood up from the piano bench and bowed to Messner. They had not been introduced before. All of the hostages greatly admired Messner, both for his calm demeanor and his seemingly magic ability to go in and out of the front door at will. "At least I'm going to be able to practice again," Roxanne said. "On the off chance that we ever get out of here, I still want to be able to sing." Messner said he hoped he would have an opportunity to hear the rehearsals. For a brief, disquieting moment, Messner felt something that was not unlike jealousy. The hostages were there all the time, so if she decided to sing first thing in the morning or in the middle of the night, they would be able to hear her. He had bought himself a portable CD player and as much of her music as he could find. At night he lay in his 2-star hotel room, paid for by the International Red Cross, and listened to her sing Norma and La Sonnambula. He would be lying alone in his uncomfortable bed looking at the spidery cracks in the ceiling, and they would all be there in the grand living room of the vice presidential estate while she sang Castadiva. Enough, Messner said to himself. I've always had closed rehearsals, Roxanne said. I don't believe that anyone is entitled to hear my mistakes. But I doubt there would be much point in trying to arrange that here. I can hardly march them all up to the attic.
They could hear you in the attic.
I'd make them stuff cotton in their ears. Roxanne laughed at this, and Messner was moved. Everything in the house seemed more tolerable since this new accompanist had stepped forward.
What can I do for you?
If Gen had been turned into a secretary, then Messner had become the errand boy. In Switzerland, he was a member of an elite arbitration team. At 42, he had had a very successful career with the Red Cross. He had not packed a box of food supplies or driven blankets to a flood site in almost 20 years. Now he was scouring the city for orange-flavored chocolate and calling a friend in Paris to send an expensive eye cream that came in a small black tub. I need music, she said, and handed over her list. Call my manager and tell him to send this overnight. Tell him to fly it down himself if he thinks there could be any problem. I want this by tomorrow.
You might have to be a little more reasonable than tomorrow, Messner said. It's already dark in Italy.
Messner and Roxanne spoke in English, with Gen discreetly translating their private conversation into Japanese. Father Arguedas sidled up to the piano, not wanting to interfere, but wanting very much to know what was being said.
Gen, he whispered, what does she need?
Sheet music, Gen said, and then remembered the question had been asked in Spanish.
A partitura.
Does Messner know who to speak to? Does he know where to go?
Gen liked the priest and didn't mean to be annoyed, but Mr. Hosokawa and Kato clearly meant to follow what was being said in Japanese, and he was falling behind on the conversation taking place in English.
They'll contact her people in Italy.
Gen turned his back on Father Arguedas and returned to the work at hand. The priest tugged at Gen's sleeve. Gen held up his hand to ask him to wait.
But I know where the music is, the priest persisted. Not 2 miles from here. There is a man that I know, a music teacher, a deacon in our parish. He loans me records. He has all the music you would need.
His voice was becoming loud. Father Arguedas, who had devoted his life to doing good works, was nearly frantic for the want of some good works to do. He helped Ruben with the laundry, and in the morning he folded all the blankets and stacked them with the pillows in neat rows against the wall, but he longed to provide assistance and guidance of a more profound nature. He couldn't help but feel he stayed just on the edge of bothering people rather than comforting them, when all that he wanted, the only thing that mattered, was to be helpful.
What is it he's saying?
Roxanne said. What are you saying? Gen asked the priest.
The music is here. You could call. Manuel would bring it over. Anything you need. If there was something he didn't have, and I can't imagine it, he would find it for you. All you need to say is that it is for Señorita Cos. You wouldn't even have to say that. He is a Christian man. If you tell him you need it for any reason, I promise he will help you.
His eyes were dazzling in their agitation. His hands leapt in front of his chest as if he was trying to offer up his own heart.
Would he have Bellini?
Roxanne asked after listening to the translation. I need songs. I need to have entire opera scores, Rossini, Verdi, Mozart. She leaned toward the priest and asked for the impossible, straight on.
Offenbach.
Offenbach, le comte de Hoffmann.
The priest's pronunciation of the French was discernible, if not good. He had only seen it written out on the record. He would have that? She said to Gen. Gen repeated the question, and the priest replied,
I have seen his scores. Call him, the name is Manuel. I would be most grateful to place the call if I were allowed.
Because General Benjamin was locked in a room upstairs holding a heating pad to his inflamed face and could not be disturbed, Messner made the request to the generals Hector and Alfredo, who granted it with bored indifference.
For Signorita Cos,
Messner explained. General Hector nodded and waved him away without looking. When Messner was almost out of the room, General Alfredo barked,
Only one call,
thinking they hadn't shown proper authority by agreeing so quickly. They were in the den watching the president's favorite soap opera. The heroine, Maria, was telling her lover she did not love him anymore, in hopes that he would leave town in desperation and thus be protected from his own brother, who, in his love for Maria, sought to murder him. Messner stood in the doorway for a moment to watch the girl on television cry. So completely convincing was her grief that it was difficult for him to turn away.
Call Manuel,
he said, coming back to the living room. Rubén went to the kitchen and brought back the telephone directory, and Messner gave the priest his cellular phone and showed him how to dial out. On the third ring, there was an answer.
Allo?
Manuel, the priest said.
Manuel, hello?
He felt his voice choke with emotion. Someone outside the house. It was like seeing a ghost from his former life, a silvery shadow walking down the aisle toward the altar. Manuel. He had not been in captivity 2 full weeks, but upon hearing that voice, the priest felt as if he were dead to the world.
Who is this?
The voice was suspicious.
It is your friend, Father Arguedas.
The priest's eyes filled with tears, and he held up his hand to excuse himself from the crowd and stepped into the corner, into the lustrous folds of the draperies. There was a long silence on the other end.
Is this a joke?
Manuel, no. I'm calling.
Father?
I am in, he said, but then faltered.
I have been detained. We know all about that. Father, are you well? Do they treat you all right? They let you make phone calls there?
I am well. I am fine. The call... No, it is a special circumstance.
We say the Mass for you every day.
Now it was his friend's voice that was breaking.
I only came home for lunch. I have only just walked in the door. If you had called 5 minutes before, I wouldn't have been here. Are you safe? We hear terrible things. They say the Mass for me?
Father Arguedas wrapped his hand around the heavy draperies and rested his cheek against the soft cloth. To the best of his knowledge, he had been remembered in the Mass along with 23 others on the Sunday before he took his holy orders, and that was all. To think of those people, the people he prayed for, praying for him. To think that God heard his name from so many voices.
And they must pray for all of us here, the hostages and captors alike.
We do, Manuel said, but the Mass is offered in your name.
I can't believe this,
he whispered. Does he have the music? Roxanne asked, and then Gen asked the priest. Father Arguedas remembered himself.
Manuel,
he coughed to try and clear the emotion from his voice.
I'm calling to ask you for a favor. Anything, my friend. Do they want money?
The priest smiled to think with all these wealthy men around, it would be put to him to ask a music teacher for money.
Nothing like that. I need sheet music. There is a singer here, Roxanne Cos. You know everything,
he said, taking comfort in his friend's concern.
She needs music to practice with. I heard her accompanist was dead, murdered by the terrorists. I heard they cut off his hands.
Father Arguedas was shocked. What else did people say about them now that they were gone?
It was nothing like that. He died all on his own. The man was a diabetic.
Should he defend the people who kept them? Surely they should not be falsely accused of cutting the hands off a pianist.
It isn't so bad here. I don't mind it, really. We've found another accompanist, someone who is here who plays very well, I think.
he said, dropping his voice to a whisper.
Perhaps even better than the first one. She wants things in a wide range. Opera scores, Bellini songs, Chopin for the accompanist. I have a list.
There is nothing she needs that I don't have, Manuel said confidently.
The priest could hear his friend rummaging for paper, a pen.
I told her that.
You spoke of me to Roxanne Koss?
Of course, that's why I'm calling.
She's heard my name?
She wants to sing from your music, the priest said.
Even when you are locked away, you manage to do good work, Manuel sighed. What an honor for me. I will bring them now. I will skip lunch completely.
The two men conferred about the list, and then Father Arguedas double-checked it with Gen. When everything was settled, the priest asked his friend to hold the line. He hesitated, and then he held out the phone to Roxanne.
Ask her to say something, he said to Gen.
What?
Anything, it doesn't matter. Ask her to say the names of the operas. Would she do that?
Gen made the request, and Roxanne Koss took the small phone from the priest's hand and held it to her ear. Hello, she said.
Hello,
Manuel parroted in English. She looked at the priest and she smiled. She looked right at him while she said the names into the phone.
La Bohème, she said. Così fan tutti.
Dear God,
Manuel whispered.
La Gioconda, I Capuletti e I Montecchi.
Madame Butterfly. It was as if a white light filled up the priest's chest, a hot sort of brightness that made his eyes water and his heart beat like a desperate man pounding on the church door at night. Had he been able to lift up his hands to touch her, he could not be sure he could have stopped himself. But it didn't matter. He was paralyzed by her voice, the music of speaking, the rhythmic loops of the names that passed through her lips into the phone and then into Manuel's ear some 2 miles away. The priest knew then for sure that he would survive this, that there would come a day when he would sit at Manuel's kitchen table in his small apartment cluttered with music, and they would shamelessly recount the pleasure of this exact moment. He would have to live, if only to have that cup of coffee with his friend, and while they would remember, try to place in order the names that she spoke. Father Arguedas would know that he had been the more fortunate of the two, because it was he whom she had looked at when she spoke.
Give me the phone, Simon Thibault said to Messner when they were done. He said one call. I couldn't care less what he said. Give me the goddamn phone.
Simon.
They're watching television. Give me the phone.
The terrorists had removed all the cords from the phones. Messner sighed and handed him the phone.
1 minute. I swear it,
Simon said. He was already dialing the number. The phone rang 5 times and then the answering machine picked up the line. It was his own voice, saying first in Spanish and then again in French that they were out, saying they would return the call. Why hadn't Edith recorded the message? What had he been thinking of? He put his hand over his eyes and began to cry. The sound of his own voice was almost unbearable to him. When it stopped, there was a long, dull tone.
Je t'adore,
he said.
Je t'aime, je t'adore.
Everyone was scattered now, wandering off to their chairs to nap or play a hand of solitaire. After Roxanne walked away and Cato returned to the letter he had been writing to his sons, he had so much to tell them now. Gen noticed that Carmen was still in her place on the other side of the room, and that she wasn't watching the singer or the accompanist anymore. She was watching him. He felt that same tightness he felt when she had looked at him before. That face, which had seemed pretty to a disadvantage when it was assigned to a boy, did not blink or move or even appear to breathe. Carmen did not wear her cap. Her eyes were large and dark and frozen onto Gen. As if by looking away, she would be admitting that she had been looking in the first place. Gen, in his genius for languages, was often at a loss for what to say when left with only his own words. If Mr. Hosokawa had still been sitting there, he might have said to Gen, "Go and see what that girl wants," and Gen would go and ask her without hesitation. It had occurred to him in his life that he had the soul of a machine, and was only capable of motion when someone else turned the key. He was very good at working, and he was very good at being by himself. Sitting alone in his apartment with books and tapes, he would pick up languages the way other men picked up women, with smooth talk, and then later passion. He would scatter books on the floor and pick them up at random. He read Czesław Miłosz in Polish, Flaubert in French, Chekhov in Russian, Nabokov in English, Mann in German. Then he switched them around, Miłosz in French, Flaubert in Russian, Mann in English. It was like a game, a showy parlor trick he performed only for himself, in which the constant switching kept his mind sharp. But it was hardly the same thing as being able to approach a person who was looking at you intently from across a room. Perhaps the generals were right about him after all. Carmen wore a wide leather belt around her narrow waist, and into the right side she had stuck a pistol. Her green fatigues were not dirty the way the fatigues of her compatriots were, and the tear in the knee of her pants had been neatly sewn together with the same needle and thread Esmeralda had used to stitch together the vice president's face. Esmeralda had left the spool with the needle sticking out of it on the side table when she had finished her work, and Carmen had surreptitiously dropped them into her pocket the first chance she got. She had been hoping to speak to the translator since she realized what it was he did, but couldn't figure out a way to speak to him without letting him know she was a girl. Then Beatrice took care of that, and now there was no secret, no reason to wait, except for the fact that she seemed to be stuck against the wall. He had seen her. He was looking at her now, and that seemed to be as far as things were able to progress. She could not walk away, and she was equally unable to walk towards him. Life could very well be lived out in that spot. She tried to remember her aggressiveness, all the things the generals had taught her in training, but it was one thing to take what you must for the good of the people, and quite another to ask for something for yourself. She knew nothing at all about asking. "Dear Gin," Messner said, clapping a hand down on his shoulder, "I've never seen you sitting alone. You must feel at times that everyone has something to say and no one knows how to say it." "At times," Gin said absently. He felt if he were to blow in her direction, she would be lifted up in the current of air and would simply bob away like a feather. "We are the handmaidens of circumstance, you and I." Messner spoke to Gin in French, the language he spoke at home in Switzerland. "What would be the male equivalent of handmaiden?" "Esclave," Gin said. "Yes, slave, of course. But it doesn't sound as nice. I think I'll stay with handmaidens, I don't mind that." Messner sat down next to Gin on the piano bench and let his eyes follow the course of Gen's stare. "My God," he said quietly. "Isn't that a girl there?" Gin told him it was. "Where did she come from? There were no girls. Don't tell me they found a way to get more of their troops inside." "She was always here," Gin said. "Two of them. We just didn't notice. That's Carmen. Beatrice, the other one, is in watching television." "We didn't notice her?" "Apparently not," Gin said, feeling quite sure he had noticed. "I was just in the den." "Then you overlooked Beatrice again." "Beatrice. And this one is Carmen?" "Well," Messner said, standing up. "And there's something wrong with the whole lot of us. Be my translator. I want to speak to her. Your Spanish is fine. My Spanish is halting, and my verbs are improperly conjugated." "Get up. Look at her again, she's staring right at you." It was true. So fearful had Carmen become when she saw that Messner meant to come towards her, that she had lost her ability to even blink. She was now staring in much the same way a figure stares from a portrait. She prayed to St. Rose of Lima to grant her that rarest of gifts, to become invisible. "Either she's been commanded to watch you on the penalty of her death, or she has something to say." Gin got up. He was a translator, he would go and translate Messner's conversation. Still, he felt a peculiar fluttering in his chest, a sensation that was not entirely dissimilar to an itch, but was located just beneath his ribs. "Such a remarkable thing, and no one even mentioned it," Messner said.
We were all thinking about the new accompanist, Gen said, his knees feeling looser with every step. Femur, patella, tibia. We had already forgotten about the girls. I suppose it's terribly sexist of me assuming that all of the terrorists were male. It's a modern world, after all. One should suppose a girl can grow up to be a terrorist just as easily as a boy. I can't imagine it, Gen said. When they were 3 feet away, Carmen found the strength to put her right hand on her gun, which immediately stopped them from coming any closer.
Do you mean to shoot us?
Messner said in French, a simple sentence he couldn't say in Spanish because he didn't know the word for shoot, a word he imagined he should make a point to learn. Gen translated, and his voice sounded uncertain. Carmen, wide-eyed, her forehead damp, said nothing.
Are we certain she speaks Spanish? Are we certain she speaks?
Messner said to Gen. Gen asked her if she spoke Spanish.
Poquito,
she whispered. Don't shoot, Messner said with good nature and pointed to the gun. Carmen pulled her hand away and crossed her arms over her chest.
I don't, she said. How old are you?
She said that she was 17 and they assumed she was telling the truth.
What is your first language?
Messner asked her. Gen asked her what she spoke at home.
Quechua, she said. We all speak Quechua, but we know Spanish.
And then, in her first attempt to address what she wanted, she said,
I should know Spanish better.
The words came out in a dull croak.
Your Spanish is good, Gen said.
The expression on her face changed with this compliment. No one could stretch the truth so much as to call it a smile, but her eyebrows lifted and her face tilted up towards them a centimeter or so as if it was drawn towards sunlight.
I am trying to learn better. So how did a girl like you get tied up with a bunch like this?
Messner said. Gen found the question overly direct, but certainly Messner knew enough Spanish to catch him if he were to ask another question entirely.
I work to free the people,
she said. Messner scratched the back of his neck.
It's always free the people. I never know exactly which people they mean or what it is they want to free them from. I certainly recognize the problems, but there's such a vagueness to free the people. It's easier to negotiate with bank robbers, really. They only want the money. They want to take the money and free themselves and the people be damned. There's something much more straightforward about that, don't you think?
Are you asking me or her? Messner looked at Carmen and apologized in Spanish.
That is rude of me, he said again. My Spanish is very poor,
Messner said to Carmen.
But I am trying to improve as well.
Si, she said. She should not be talking to them like this. The generals could come in. Anyone could see her. She was too much out in the open.
Are you being treated well? Are you in good health?
Si, she said again, although she wasn't sure why he was asking.
She's really a very lovely girl, he said again in French. She has a remarkable face. It's almost a perfect heart. Don't tell her that, though. She looks like the kind that could die of embarrassment.
Then he turned to Carmen.
If there's anything you need, you let one of us know.
Si, she said, just barely able to make a sound come out with the shape of the word.
You don't see many shy terrorists, Messner said in French.
They all stood there as if it was a painful moment at a long, dull cocktail party.
You like the music?
Gen said.
Very beautiful, she whispered. It was Chopin.
Kato played Chopin? Messner said. The Nocturnes?
I'm sorry I missed that.
Chopin played, Carmen said.
No, Gen said. The man who played was Signor Kato. The music he played was written by Signor Chopin.
Very beautiful,
she said again, and suddenly her eyes welled up with tears. And she parted her lips slightly, not to speak, but to breathe.
What is the matter?
Messner said. He was going to touch her shoulder and then thought better of it. The big boy named Gilbert called to her from the other side of the room, and
Hearing her name, it was as if her power of movement was restored. She quickly rubbed her eyes and stepped around the two men without so much as nodding. They turned and watched her dart off across the wide expanse of the living room and then disappear down the hall with the boy.
"Perhaps the music was getting to her," Messner said.
Gen stood watching the empty place where she had been.
"It would be hard on a girl," he said, "all of this."
And while Messner started to say it was hard on them all, he knew what Gen meant, and frankly, he agreed. Whenever Messner left, there was a lingering sadness in the house that could last for hours. It was very quiet inside, and no one listened to the tedious messages the police continued to broadcast from the other side of the wall. Hopeless, surrender, will not negotiate. It droned on until the words simply broke down into a dull buzz, the angry sound of hornets scouring the nest. They imagined what prisoners felt like when the visiting hour was over, and there was nothing left to do but sit in their cell and wonder if it was dark yet outside. They were still deep in their afternoon bout of depression, still thinking about all the elderly relatives they never went to visit, when Messner knocked again. Simon Thibault lifted his face from the blue scarf that hung around his neck, and General Benjamin motioned for the vice president to answer the door. Ruben took a moment to untie the dish towel from his waist. The people with the guns motioned for him to hurry. It was Messner, they knew it. Only Messner came to the door.
"What a lovely surprise," the vice president said.
Messner was standing on the front steps, struggling to hold a heavy box in his arms. The generals had thought that this knockout of schedule indicated a breakthrough, a chance to put this thing to rest. They were that hopeless, that hopeful. When they saw it was only another delivery, they felt a crush of disappointment. They wanted none of it.
"This isn't his time," General Alfredo said to Gen. "He knows what times he is allowed to come."
General Alfredo had fallen asleep in his chair. He had suffered from terrible insomnia ever since their arrival at the vice president's estate, and anyone who woke him from the little sleep he managed would live to regret it. He always dreamed of bullets zipping past his ears. When he woke up, his shirt was drenched, his heart was racing, and he was always more exhausted than he had been before he slept.
"It seemed to me to be a special circumstance," Messner said. "The music has arrived." "We are an army," Alfredo said sharply, "not a conservatory. Come at your time tomorrow, and we will discuss the issue of allowing music."
Roxanne Koss asked Gen if it was her music, and when he told her yes, she was on her feet. The priest approached the door as well.
"These are from Manuel?" "He's just on the other side of the wall," Messner said. "He sent this all for you."
Father Arguedas pressed his folded hands to his lips.
"Ever powerful and merciful God, we do well always and everywhere to give you thanks and praise."
"Both of you, sit down," General Alfredo said.
"I'll put this inside the door," Messner said and started to bend down. It was surprising how much music could weigh.
"No," Alfredo said.
He had a headache. He was sick to death of giving in on things. There needed to be some order to this business, some respect for authority. Wasn't he the man with the gun? Didn't that count for something? If he said the box would not come inside, then the box would not come inside. General Benjamin whispered something in Alfredo's ear, but Alfredo simply repeated his point.
"No."
Roxanne pulled on Gen's arm.
"Isn't that mine? Tell them that."
Gen asked if the box belonged to Miss Koss.
"Nothing belongs to Señorita Koss. She is a prisoner like the rest of you. This is not her home. There is no special mail service that applies only to her. She does not receive packages."
The tone of Alfredo's voice made all the junior terrorists stand up straight and look menacing. For many of them, all this took was to put their hands on their guns. Messner sighed and shifted the weight in his arms.
"Then I will come back tomorrow."
He spoke in English now. He spoke to Roxanne and let Gen translate for the generals. He had not left. He had barely started to turn away from the house when Roxanne Koss closed her eyes and opened her mouth. In retrospect, it was a risky thing to do, both from the perspective of General Alfredo, who might have seen it as an act of insurrection, and from the care of the instrument of the voice itself. She had not sung in 2 weeks, nor did she go through a single scale to warm up. Roxanne Koss, wearing Mrs. Iglesias' slacks and a white dress shirt belonging to the vice president, stood in the middle of the vast living room and began to sing O Mio Bambino Caro from Puccini's Gianni Schicchi. There should have been an orchestra behind her, but no one noticed its absence. No one would have said her voice sounded better with an orchestra, or that it was better when the room was immaculately clean and lit by candles. They did not notice the absence of flowers or champagne. In fact, they knew now that flowers and champagne were unnecessary embellishments. Had she really not been singing all along? The sound was no more beautiful when her voice was limber and warm. Their eyes clouded over with tears for so many reasons it would be impossible to list them all. They cried for the beauty of the music, certainly, but also for the failure of their plans. They were thinking of the last time they had heard her sing, and longed for the women who had been beside them then. All of the love and the longing a body can contain was spun into not more than 2.5 minutes of song, and when she came to the highest notes, it seemed that all they had been given in their lives, and all they had lost, came together and made a weight that was almost impossible to bear. When she was finished, the people around her stood in stunned and shivering silence. Messner leaned into the wall as if struck. He had not been invited to the party. Unlike the others, he had never heard her sing before. Roxanne took a deep breath and rolled her shoulders.
"Tell him," she said again, "that's it. Either he gives me that box right now, or you will not hear another note out of me, or that piano, for the duration of this failed social experiment."
"Really?"
Gen asked.
"I don't bluff," the soprano said. So Gen related the message, and all eyes turned to General Alfredo. He pinched the bridge of his nose and tried to push down the headache, but it didn't work. The music had confused him to the point of senselessness. He could not hold on to his convictions. Now he was thinking of his sister, who had died of scarlet fever when he was just a boy. These hostages were like terrible children, always wanting more for themselves. They knew nothing of what it meant to suffer. He would have been glad to walk out of the house at that moment and take whatever fate was waiting for him on the other side of the wall, a lifetime in prison or a bullet in the head. With so little sleep, he was in no condition to make decisions. Every possible conclusion seemed like madness. Alfredo turned and left the room, walking down the long hallway towards the vice president's study. After a time, the faint voices of television news could be heard, and General Benjamin told Messner to get inside and sharply instructed his soldiers to check thoroughly the contents of the box for anything that was not music. He tried to make it sound as if it was his decision, that he was the one in charge, but even he could see this was no longer true. The soldiers took the box from Messner and emptied it out on the floor. There were loose scores and bound books, hundreds of pages covered in the alphabet of song. They sifted through them and separated them, shaking out handfuls as if there might be money caught between the pages.
"Amazing," Messner said. "I watched the police tear through them outside, and now we have to go through it all again."
Cato went and knelt down beside the boys. Once they had checked a piece of paper, Cato took it from them. He carefully separated Rossini from Verdi, put Chopin with Chopin. Sometimes he would stop and read a page as if it were a letter from home, his head swaying with the timed beat. When he found something of particular interest, he would take it to Roxanne and hand it to her, bowing from the waist. He did not ask for Gen to translate. Everything she needed to know was there.
"Manuel sends you his best regards," Messner told Father Arguedas. "He said if there is anything else that is needed, he will find it for you."
The priest knew he committed the sin of pride, and still he was overjoyed at having been able to play a role in bringing in the music. He was still too dizzy from the sound of Roxanne's voice to express himself properly. He looked to see if the windows were open. He hoped that Manuel had been able to hear a line, a note, from where he stood on the sidewalk. What a blessing he had received in his captivity. The mysteries of Christ's love had never been closer to him, not when he said the Mass or received communion, not even on the day he took holy orders. He realized now he was only just beginning to see the full extent to which it was his destiny to follow, to walk blindly into fates he could never understand. In fate there was reward. In turning over one's heart to God, there was a magnificence that lay beyond description. At the moment one is sure that all is lost, look at what is gained. Roxanne Coss did not sing again that day. Her voice had been asked to do enough. Now she contented herself to look through the scores, sitting on the small couch by the window with Mr. Hosokawa. When one of them had something to say, they would call again, but what was surprising was how rarely they needed him. He was a comfort to her. In the absence of language, she believed that he agreed with her completely. She would hum a little of the scores quietly so that he knew what she was looking at, and then they would look at the pages together. Mr. Hosokawa could not read music, but he accepted that. He did not speak the language of the libretto, the singer, or the host. He was beginning to feel more at ease with all he had lost, all he didn't know. Instead, he was astonished by what he had. The chance to sit beside this woman in the late afternoon light, while she read. Her hand brushed his as she set the pages down on the couch between them, and then her hand rested on top of his hand, while she continued to read. After a while, Kato approached them. He bowed to Roxanne and then bowed again to Mr. Hosokawa.
"Do you think it would be all right if I played?"
Kato asked his employer.
"I think it would be fine," Mr. Hosokawa said.
"You don't think it would disturb her reading?"
Roxanne watched while Mr. Hosokawa pantomimed playing the piano and then nodded to Kato.
"Yes,"
she said, nodding. She held out her hand for the music. Kato handed it to her.
"Sati,"
he said.
"Sati."
She smiled and nodded again. Kato went to the piano and he played. It wasn't like the last time he had played, when no one could believe that such a talent had been in the room among them without anyone knowing it. It was nothing like Roxanne's singing, where it seemed that everyone's heart would have to wait until she had finished before it could beat again. The sati was only music. They could hear its beauty without being paralyzed by it. The men were able to read their books or look out the window while Kato played. Roxanne continued to leaf through the scores, though every now and then she stopped and closed her eyes. Only Mr. Hosokawa and the priest completely understood the importance of the music. Every note was distinct. It was the measurement of the time which had gotten away from them. It was the interpretation of their lives in the very moment they were being lived. There was one other person there who understood the music, but she was not a guest. Standing in the hallway, looking around the corner to the living room, was Carmen. And Carmen, though she did not have the words for it, understood everything perfectly. This was the happiest time of her life, and it was because of the music. When she was a child dreaming on her pallet at night, she never dreamed of pleasures like these. None of her family, left behind in the mountains, could have understood that there was a house made of bricks and sealed glass windows that was never too hot or too cold. She could not have believed that somewhere in the world there was a vast expanse of carpet embroidered to look like a meadow of flowers, or that ceilings came tipped in gold, or that there could be pale marble women who stood on either side of a fireplace and balanced the mantelpiece on their heads. And that would have been enough, the music and the paintings and the garden which she patrolled with her rifle. But in addition, there was food that came every day, so much food that some was always wasted no matter how hard they tried to eat it all. There were deep white bathtubs with an endless supply of hot water pouring out of the curved silver spigots. There were stacks of soft white towels and pillows and blankets trimmed in satin and so much space inside that you could wander off and no one would know where you had gone. Yes, the generals wanted something better for the people, but weren't they the people? Would it be the worst thing in the world if nothing happened at all, if they all stayed together in this generous house? Carmen prayed hard. She prayed while standing near the priest, in hopes it would give her request extra credibility. What she prayed for was nothing. She prayed that God would look on them and see the beauty of their existence, and leave them alone. It was Carmen's night for watch. There was a long wait before everyone had gone to sleep, some of them red with flashlights, others tossed and stretched in the great room where they all bedded down together. They were like children, up and down for water and then the bathroom. But once they were all still, she crept around their bodies and went to look at Gen. He was in his usual place, sleeping on his back on the floor next to the sofa where his employer slept. Gen had taken his glasses off, and in his sleep he held them lightly in one hand. He had a pleasant face, a face that stored a wonderment of knowledge. She could see his eyes moving quickly back and forth beneath the smooth, thin skin of his eyelids, but if he was dreaming, everything else was still. His breathing was quiet and steady. Carmen wished that she could see inside his mind. She wondered if it would look crowded with words, compartments of language carefully fitted on top of each other. Her own brain, by comparison, would be an empty closet. He could refuse her, and what would be the harm in that? She wouldn't have anything less than what she had now. All she had to do was ask. All she had to do was say the words, and yet the thought of it closed her throat entirely. What experience did she have of piano music and paintings of the Madonna? What experience did she have of asking? Carmen held her breath and stretched out on the floor next to Gen. She was as silent as light on the leaves of trees. She lay on her side and put her mouth near his sleeping ear. She had no talent for asking, but she was a genius at being quiet. When they practiced their drills in the woods, it was Carmen who could run for a mile without breaking a twig. It was Carmen who could walk up right behind you and tap you on the shoulder without making a sound. She was the one they sent in first to unscrew the covers from the air conditioning vents because no one would notice her. No one would hear a thing. She said a prayer to St. Rose of Lima. She asked for courage. After so many prayers offered for the gift of silence, she now asked for sound.
Gen, she whispered.
Gen was dreaming that he was standing on a beach in Greece looking at the water. Somewhere behind him in the dunes, someone was saying his name. Her heart was stuttering in her chest. The rush of her blood made a roar in her ears. What she heard when she strained to listen was the voice of the saint.
Now or never, St. Rose told her. I am with you only for this moment. Gen.
And now the voice that was calling was walking away, and Gen left the beach to follow it, followed the voice from sleep to waking. It was always so confusing waking up in the vice president's house. What hotel room was this? Why was he on the floor? Then he remembered, and all at once he opened his eyes, thinking it was Mr. Hosokawa who needed him. He looked up to the sofa, but then he felt a hand on his shoulder. When he turned his head, the beautiful boy was there, not the boy, Carmen. Her nose very nearly touching his nose. He was startled, but not afraid. How odd that she was lying down, was all he thought. The military had recently given up on the floodlights that had raged for so long outside the windows, and now the night looked like night again.
Carmen,
he said. Messner should see her like this in the moonlight. He had been so right about her face, her heart-shaped face.
Very quiet,
she said deep into his ear.
Listen.
But where were the words? She was so thankful to be lying down. The racing of her heart was unbearable. Could he see her like this in the darkness, shaking? Could he feel her vibration deep in the wood of the floor? Could he hear her skin rustling inside the clothes she wore?
Close your eyes, St. Rose told her. Say your prayer to me.
All at once there was enough air to fill her lungs.
Teach me to read,
she said quickly.
Teach me to make my letters in Spanish.
Gen looked at her. Her eyes were closed. It was as if he had come to lie down beside her and not the other way around. Her lashes were heavy and dark against the blush of her cheek. Was she asleep? Was she talking in her sleep? He could have kissed her without moving an inch, and then he struck the thought from his mind.
You want to read in Spanish?
Gen repeated, his voice as small as her own. Heaven, she thought, he knows how to be quiet. He knows, like me, how to speak without making a sound. She took a breath and then blinked her dark eyes open.
And English,
she whispered. She smiled. She could not contain it. She had managed to ask him for everything she wanted. Shy Carmen, always hanging back from the others, who knew she could smile. But at the sight of that smile, he would have promised her anything. He was just barely awake, or maybe he was not awake at all. Had he wanted her and not known it? Had he wanted her so much that he dreamed she was lying beside him now? The things our minds keep from us, Gen thought. The secrets we keep even from ourselves.
Yes,
he said, English. She was reckless and brave, so great was her joy. She took her hand and put it over his eyes. She gently brushed his eyes closed again. Her hand was cool and soft. It smelled of metal.
Go back to sleep,
she said.
Go back to sleep.